Hello, friends, and welcome back to another episode of the podcast. I want to just give you a little bit of a warning for this episode. Addiction, human trafficking, and suicide are mentioned. So if any of these subjects really are triggering for you, please take care of yourself and maybe skip this episode. I will let you know that my conversation with Lillian Easterly Smith is one that reminded me of the resilience that we all possess. It reminded me of the just tenacious nature of the human spirit and how even at our lowest points, we have the ability to rise. Now, Lillian has created a very special place, Aruka Ranch in Florida. And Lillian shares a really powerful story of how she got to the place in her life where she had the strength, the vision, the imagination to change people's worlds. And let me give you a hint. It was after she changed her own world, her own life, and worked with what had happened to her, and then realized that she could bring what she learned to others. She's an incredible woman. She's someone who doesn't give up. And her miracle, well, in my mind, is actually herself. It's also that she's translated her experiences and, like the hero or heroine in Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, she's bringing the treasure that she found there to everyone else. So now, let's get to Lillian and my incredible conversation with her this week.
My first marriage came out of my addiction. I was 17 years old, clueless what I was doing. And that was not a good situation. I have a wonderful daughter who came out of that marriage, and we're like best friends now. It hasn't always been that case. You know, we had the teenage years where we're like this, but she's like my best friend now. Describe myself as a person who is a thriver, not just a survivor. And it took a lot of work to get to where I am, but I think also because of my experiences, there's value in what I want to offer people, because what I have in my life, I really want that for everyone. And that's peace and freedom and joy, despite circumstances.
Absolutely. I love that. I think after 270 interviews, you are the first person to introduce yourself that way. And I love it, that word thriver. I think people don't think about that word enough. And I mean, frankly, I also think a lot of people are just trying to survive these days, just in general, with everything that's going on. What do you do for a living now? What's your vocation?
Okay. A little bit of everything, to be honest with you. It's been a long journey, and part of why I do so many things is because I started out in one area and then I realized, okay, there's more. And I need to equip myself to be able to help people in this area, and this area, and this area. So I take a holistic approach. You know, it's body, soul, spirit. So I do counseling, lifestyle coaching. I recently became a brain health coach, and I'm also a fitness instructor.
I love it. You do it all. You're kind of a one-stop shop. I feel like we need those kinds of people in the world. I saw you do pastoral counseling too, and I think that's also an essential component to any sort of journey to recovery. I love asking this next question. When you were a kid, what did you dream about being when you grew up?
What did I dream about being when I grew up? You know, the interesting thing is, and it's interesting that you would ask me that question, because that is a question that oftentimes I'm working with my clients on, because either their dreams were thwarted or they never had any dreams because they really didn't believe that they were going to survive to even get to adulthood. That's how traumatic their lives have been. And honestly, I grew up in a very traumatic situation as well. You know, alcoholism was rampant in my family. So I know that oftentimes when I thought about my future, I didn't give it a second thought. And so it was like just a glimpse of something. And so there was never, I mean, it wasn't encouraged in my household to dream or to pursue anything in the future. So I think because of the fear that we were living in at that time, and throughout even up until my late teenage years, I never really gave it a second thought, you know? Now, I would say probably once I got into recovery myself, that's when my dreams came alive. And in my, I would say my late 20s, early 30s, I started really thinking about, I want to be able to help people. I really do. I want to do something that would be significant for other people's lives, so that they can get well and be free.
Yeah. And be free. Truly, truly. I remember meeting with a therapist, I don't know, maybe about 5 or 6 years ago here in Santa Fe. And we'd been seeing each other for a couple of years. And one day I said, you never know when these groundbreaking things are going to happen. I said, you know what? I am actually grateful for all of the things that happened that I endured when I was a kid, because it's made me who I am. And I kind of like that person. That person's strong and they're resilient and they can handle challenges and pretty happy and full of joy. Is that where you're trying to take your clients?
Yes, absolutely. I believe that every person on the planet has some form of trauma and also false beliefs that have to be tended to. And I think that if we can focus on not just these are the bad things that happened, but these are the absence of good things that I needed in order to become that healthy, free adult. So I deal with both. But yes, my goal is to help them to become completely whole and be transformed and get to a place where it's like they're comfortable in their own skin. They really realize that their life has meaning, value, purpose. Those things are important, you know, to help people to get there.
Yeah, absolutely. And that day when I said that, my therapist said, yes, yes, that's what we want to hear. That is the sentence that I've been waiting for you to say. And I thought, what? Okay. So it was kind of a revelatory process for me. You know, when you began, I don't know, when you embarked on this work, maybe when you dipped your toe in or stepped forward with conviction into this work, were you scared at all? Was it nerve-wracking at all? Or did you truly feel called?
It really wasn't nerve-wracking at all. I felt called. However, I knew that I also needed to be equipped. I needed to know more than what I had personally known for my own personal growth and experience and healing process. Even though there's tremendous value in that, I knew that I needed both. So that's why I went back to college and got my degrees and, you know, pursued all of that. But I never stopped helping people, even in the midst of my being equipped. So, you know, there's plenty of places you can volunteer and invest in people's lives, which is exactly what I did. And And to be honest with you, I kind of fought the whole thing about going back to school because I hadn't gone to college. So it wasn't like I had my associate's degree or had anything. I had no college experience at all. Here I'm an adult. I have a daughter. I'm married. And I'm like, okay. And I have to go to school. So I was like, really? Can't I just do what I'm doing and not have to do all that? So it was like, I really think I heard God's voice at that moment. And he said, you know, you have to do the things that you need to do in order to get to where you need to go. So I'm like, okay. And so there was value in my training, a lot of value, because there were things that I learned that helped me. And then also helped me in my volunteer work until I got to a place where I could actually make it a career.
Amazing. And I'm actually curious because I went back and got my Master's of Divinity when I was in my 40s. For you, what was it like going back to school? I kind of loved it because I've always loved school, but I also love meeting new people. So it was really captivating for me to meet all these new people in my program. And I love to learn. And so I learned a lot. What was your college experience like?
You know, I really enjoyed it. I did. I loved every minute of it. So all of that, you know, fighting about it was like, it all went away once I got started. And, you know, for a little while though, I felt a little odd, like the odd duck in the classroom, because a lot of my classes that I took, they were all young people. And here I am, like I could be, you know, your older sister or your mom in some cases. But I loved every minute of it. I truly did. I took, you know, some Bible classes as well as my counseling stuff. And man, it was just great. Now, some of the general eds that you have to get through, those were like, oh, really? But I did have a greater appreciation even for those things because I was going to school, you know, later in life. So there is some benefits to going later in life. I really think you take it a lot more seriously. And I think your mind is much more open to seeing the value in everything that's being presented to you. So it was good. I loved it. I really did.
Oh my gosh, please.
Until the end, let's be honest. Once you get close to the end, you're like, I can't wait till I'm done reading textbooks and I can read whatever I want. Because it felt to me like school was 24/7, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was 24/7. So if you weren't finishing one thing, you're getting ready to write a paper about the other or preparing for a test. So it's not like having a job where you're working from this hour to this hour. It was like, it was all the time. You're thinking, okay, and planning and preparing for. So at the end, it was kind of like, oh, I can't wait till this is done. Yeah, but I genuinely, you know, like you, I did love it. And I love the connection with other students and the value that's there in learning from each other. And I had some of the most amazing professors. And I share this with others that go to school. It's important to try to find an institution where the professors and the teacher they're teaching you to learn well and to use your own mind and your own thoughts and to figure things out instead of, this is what I believe, so this is what you should believe.
Yeah.
You know, so I had professors that would say, you know, some people believe this, some believe this, some believe this, some believe this. You need to figure it out and you need to own whatever it is that you believe and be able to back it up. So I loved that.
I love that too. I was listening to you and I thought, yes, that's the kind of professors that you want. So please tell me that one of the gen ed requirements was not gym. Please tell me it wasn't gym.
No.
Thank
no.
goodness.
No gym. No. There were things that were required that, you know, there topics that I used to hate, like when I was in high school or whatever. And Like I never really liked history. I just didn't. But boy, when you start looking at religious history, like the history of the church, and you start looking at history as it relates to even what we've learned spiritually and what the Bible teaches and a variety of different things that are out there and what other people believe, there's so much value in that. Yeah. And so I ended up really enjoying history. Never thought I would say those words. Yeah, I loved it.
It is. I love history. I mean, okay. I sort of did not like history in high school. For me, it was just a whole bunch of memorization. And there wasn't really a lot of, I don't know, exploration or, you know, and you can blame the professor, you can blame the institution, whatever, whatever. There are just some things I'm interested in and some things I'm not. And history has never been one of my favorites just because it's, I love, you know what I love? I love people's stories inside history. So maybe the way they've transformed or transformed their communities or their countries or, you know, done something that's created beauty for other people. Those are the kinds of stories I like. Memorizing dates and I don't get it. You and I are alike in that
way. Yes.
I would love to ask you, so the second question I always ask is, did you grow up in a religious household? And if so, what did that look like? And then how has that evolved over time, your connection to God or spirit?
Okay. No. The answer is no. Did not grow up in a religious household. There were people in my family, extended family, that I would say were religious. But the majority of the people that I was around growing up, I think they had a belief in God, but he certainly was not an integral part of their life. But we did have some neighbors that had children that were our age. And so those neighbors really invested in us spiritually. You know, they would invite us to come to certain things. And at one point, my mom, you know, she was getting involved somewhat and then stopped. But, you know, we continued on, at least going with our neighbors until I was probably a teenager. So there was a good solid block of time, I guess, for me and my three sisters. As far as that goes, I guess because of that, it laid a foundation for belief so that all of that came rushing back to me once crisis began to hit and my own dysfunction started reaping the, you know, the consequences of some really bad choices. So that's when it all kind of came back and it's like, okay, I need help. I mean, being my own God is not working. And I was probably the first of many in my family that really got a clue spiritually. And then after that happened and I got into recovery, then they started watching and seeing the change in me. And then when crisis hit their life, I was the go-to. And, you know, what are you doing? I want what you have. And so it's a beautiful thing. It's been a beautiful journey and just really seeing how, you know, you don't have to convince anybody. You can influence them just by being you and allowing the changes to happen. So yeah, they will ask.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say that it sounds like you became the model for them. When they were going through their challenges, their crises, as you said, their catastrophes. And, but I can't even imagine what it was like to be the first one, you know, trying to emerge out of that, you know, go into recovery. Was there anyone in particular who inspired you around that time?
You know, the interesting thing was, probably about 7 years before I got into recovery, my dad got sober and got into recovery. So we started seeing some changes in him. And he was one of the first people that I wanted to talk to when I really hit my bottom. And that included like a suicide attempt.
Okay.
And when I talked to him, he was basically like, I can't tell you one way or the other. You need to figure this out. I can give you information that's going to help you to figure out what you need to do and what's going on. So he was very instrumental, I think, in the beginning. But like you were saying, being the first one, I mean, he was, but there was so much distance, you know, miles, you know, it wasn't like he was here and we could, you know, go to meetings together or do any of that together. So when I started my journey, it was very lonely, extremely lonely, because everybody that I knew were into the party scene. And I actually had somebody, one of my coworkers, told me, and I'll never forget it, I liked you better when you drank. Like, what? Yeah. Because that was just, yeah. Yep. Couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe I heard those words. So it was pretty lonely in the beginning. So coworkers, you know, they think you're weird because you're so different. I worked in an insurance sales office, group sales. And so drinking was just a part of everything. I mean, you'd go to lunch and you'd have drinks and everybody would go out after. So I stopped all of that. And I was like, nope, I don't have the desire anymore. I don't want that life anymore. Yeah. And they tried to lure me back into that too. There were a couple of people in particular, but I was like, no, I don't want any part of that anymore.
Yeah. When I was younger, you know, my 20s and 30s, I actually have an allergy to alcohol that I didn't understand that I had until later in life. So I actually can't drink that much. Thank goodness. But, you know, off and on moving around, doing different things. I always worked in restaurants or coffee shops. I liked the freedom of that. I worked in corporate America for a while and I thought, I cannot do this. I want freedom. So I walked away from that and kind of explored the US and lived other places. And it was really interesting, the culture in coffee shops and restaurants and so many other places, of course. But, you know, if you didn't go out, many of my coworkers would all go out at the end of the night and just drink till 1 or 2 in the morning every single day. And I mean, that, first of all, that just sounds boring to me. The other thing is I like being around people. I can work in a restaurant, but I really appreciate being alone and reading and just having some quiet. So I went home because it helped my nervous system. Also, I have an allergy to alcohol and I don't want to spend my time hanging out with my coworkers. But, you know, at every single place, I was singled out as the odd duck because I did not want to go out and drink every day. And that can be really isolating and really lonely as well. Just like you were saying, I mean, I think it's shocking that your coworker said that to you. I'm like, oh my God, you know, it doesn't even witness or stand up for the process that you were going through, you know, the incredibly, insanely challenging and probably painful process that you were going through in recovery. I'm listening to you and it's brought back some memories that, you know, I didn't belong. And they told me that because I didn't go out and drink like they did. And that it's, you know, I never wanted to, even though they said you don't belong, I never wanted to. It's really such a shame. I'm sorry that happened to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Terrible. But, you know, like you were saying earlier, We can look back now and we can see how, you know, that developed our character and expanded our heart. We have more patience with people. And I think a depth of understanding that a lot of people don't have because of the hardship that we've gone through and enduring the meanness of people that are basically ignorant. Let's face it. Ignorant.
I just think this world is so beautiful and there's so much to see. Just totally sober. This world is so beautiful. And I want to be in this life as deeply as I can. And I feel like alcohol and drugs kind of takes you away from the reality of the world, which, I mean, that's what they're supposed to do. That's what people want. But I don't want that. And I've never wanted that. I've always wanted to be deeply invested in the world. I feel like every moment, you know, that you're not is a wasted minute or a wasted moment. I want to just tell you that you're so brave. And you are resilient. Oh my goodness. I wanted to ask you now, before you went into recovery, you know, for a few months or so beforehand, did you think something's got to change? Like, I just feel like or was it a moment where you just thought all at once, oh my goodness, things have to change?
I think that I was probably for at least 6 months to a year, I knew that things needed to change. So I was trying to control my drinking. And I think a lot of people do that. They think, well, I'll just cut back because you're not ready to really give it up. In fact, you can't even imagine what life would be like without it, because the majority of people started so young. It's kind of like what you're saying when you were talking about just being able to, you know, be in nature and be mindful of what's going on around you. If you've never known that, you don't even know you're missing it. So I didn't even know I was missing it until actually after I'd enjoyed sobriety for probably a good year. But yes, I was beginning to see things were unraveling in my life. Relationships were unraveling. I was on the verge of divorce. I mean, there were things that I did that I didn't think I would ever do. And, you know, driving in a blackout, not even remembering how I got home, and just horrible stuff. And I'm just like, this is, you know, I got to get a grip. And so, yeah, I was trying to control and I was trying to make changes, but I needed a radical change. And obviously that's what ended up happening. But my bottom really got to the point where, you know, people didn't want to be around me because I was such a disappointment. And I had hurt them so deeply, especially my family. So I was like, you know what? You get to the point where you start losing hope, and then you have everyone against you. So it feels like everyone's against you. So I was like, why am I even here? And that's what led to my suicide attempt, because I really got to a point where I thought, you know what? They would be better off, and this world would be better off if I wasn't even here. So alcohol, as many pills as I could take, and just writing letters to everybody, just saying goodbye. And, you know, but I really think that that was my spiritual awakening right there, because I got to a point in all of that where I came to this realization, and I know it was God, but the realization was, you don't want to die. You just don't want to hurt anymore. And I felt that somehow the breath of hope was breathed into me in that moment. And so I thought, okay, well, I'm going to make myself throw up. I never went to the hospital. And I didn't have any damage, but there should have been, because for 3 days after that, I was so sick. And, you know, when I made myself throw up, it was almost like I was just throwing up probably every 5-10 minutes. It was just horrendous. But I survived that. without ever going to the hospital. And I didn't even tell anybody about this until months and months and months later, once I was into recovery. So after I got my, you know, got myself back together, probably a week or two after that is when I went and visited my dad. And then the other thing that I wanted to do is I wanted to connect with God, because I really believed that he was the one who spoke to me. So I had been being invited to church from someone, and I was like, okay, I need to talk to my dad. I need to get to church. And those are the two things that I did. And that just, wow, my world was finally turned right side up, and recovery started, the healing process started, reconnecting with God and getting closer to him and realizing that, you know, he was my only hope. It made all the difference in the world. So that's what started my journey. So did I know that things needed to change for a while? Yes. But did I know how to do it and what to do? No. My ways were not working.
Thank you for telling me all that. And I'm so sorry that you had to go through that journey. And but I'm grateful that you had this revelation in the middle of it, and you emerged on the other side and were convicted and knew the steps that you had to take. And I love that you accepted the invitation to church, because I feel like when invitations are extended to us, sometimes we should say yes. And so I love that you accepted the invitation. Well, this might seem like a little bit of a silly question, because I feel like I know the answer already, but did this experience, your recovery, did it all lead to you creating and envisioning the ranch where you do the work that you do?
It certainly did. I started out by launching a nonprofit, and in the nonprofit, that's when we were doing like our own support groups for people to come to get healing. And what I discovered early on in my own recovery was like, okay, I don't want to just treat the symptom. I've got to go deeper than that and try to figure out why I do the things that I do and get the healing from those things. Then yeah, addictions and all the other stuff, compulsions, it's not a temptation anymore because I'm at peace. I can make peace with my past. I can get rid of my character defects and do the work of the 12-step program, as well as some other things. So anyway, with that, launching a nonprofit that focused on some of these things, but then as time went on and I'm helping people, it's like, okay, there's more that we have to do. And that's where the health and wellness piece came in, and fitness, nutrition, supplements. And then as I've grown in that area, even over the last, 5 to 10 years, really learning a lot more about alternative health modalities and how the brain, needs to be tended to. There's so much inflammation, and how we can rewire the brain with some of these modalities that exist. So it was like, okay, we're doing this, but I think we can do more. I think we can do better. So let's do the ranch, create a safe place for people to be able to come, whether it is that they're commuting back and forth and taking advantage of all of the things that we have available here, or eventually, we hope to have some residential spaces where they can come and stay for short periods of time, because with no distractions. And I think that that's critical, too. So, yeah, that's how all of this has kind of just been growing over time. And so here we are, Aruka Ranch. And did you look up what the word Aruka means? It's so powerful.
I did not know. What does it mean?
Okay. It's a Hebrew word. And it means to heal restore, and rebuild to bring into wholeness body, soul, spirit.
Wow.
So that is exactly what we want to provide, all of those things. And that's a perfect word for what we're doing here.
That's amazing. I think, you know, you spoke about this earlier, but I think places like you've cultivated your beautiful ranch, people feel so alone, no matter, you know, what the recovery journey looks like. I imagine it can be really isolating and also very lonely. And just the fact that you're fostering this space or this place where people are welcomed, where they can feel safe. I love that you use that word, where they feel like they belong. Because as you stated, you know, when you go into recovery, you kind of lose a lot of belonging because you're choosing an alternate lifestyle to the one that you were previously living. But that includes a whole lot of people that were a part of your life that are still continuing on, you know, whether it's drinking or smoking marijuana or whatever that looks like. I just so am so grateful that you're creating this space and this place for people to belong, because I think that belonging is such food for people. So I'm so grateful.
I agree. Yeah. It's a need. It's not a want. It's a need. We need to have a sense of belonging. We need community. We truly do. You got to find your tribe, and that tribe of people has to be people that are going in the same direction and not the opposite. And then you'll find where you fit. You know, I think everybody needs to find a place where they feel like they really fit.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Oh my goodness. Well, you know, the main question of the podcast is, and I feel like you've already told a few stories, but the main question is, I would so appreciate if you would share a story, or it can be more than one story, where you feel like you've witnessed or experienced something magical, miraculous, or mysterious in your life. I'd love to hear whatever you'd like to share.
Okay. Do you want the story about my life, or someone that I've actually invested in, and a story about their life and the transformation?
We can do both if you feel we have plenty of time. So,
okay. Yeah. Okay. One of the things that we really hone in on when we're helping people is their beliefs, you know, false beliefs that they have, lies that they believe. And even in my own personal life, this is my second marriage, and I've been married to Mike now for 18 years. My first marriage came out of my addiction. I was 17 years old, clueless what I was doing. And that was not a good situation. I have a wonderful daughter who came out of that marriage, and we're like best friends now. It hasn't always been that case. You know, we had the teenage years or like this, but she's like my best friend now. But when I got married again, I mean, I never wanted to get married again. And it wasn't fear necessarily. It wasn't like, oh, I don't need a man in my life, I'm independent. It wasn't like that. It was just like, you know, my life is good. I have wonderful friends. I have all of these things that I'm doing. I mean, my life was full and I felt fulfilled. But I really believe God had another plan. And so with my second marriage, my marriage now to Mike, there was a situation that we were going through. And this is pretty miraculous, because I have learned these principles of recovery that are so deep. They are ingrained in me. I live and breathe them. So we're standing in the kitchen and we're getting into this battle. And I mean, I'm serious. My emotions were like $500 worth of emotion. I was like, I want a divorce, get out. And I know it was something that was absolutely ridiculous that was going on, but I'm like, man, what is going on with me here? You know, what's really happening here? And there was just a voice in my head, and basically the voice said, he is not fill in the blank, which was my ex. And you know what? Just coming to that realization that I was thinking, oh yeah, I've been here before. I know exactly where this is headed, right? Because our experiences will keep manifesting over and over. They're cyclical until somebody stops and says, whoa, wait a minute. It's not that at all. And that's what happened in that situation. And so that was miraculous. And just, I just calmed down, all the emotions subsided. We were able to talk through the disagreement. And I was like, wow, if I didn't understand these principles and understand that there is a God who does work miracles, you know, that probably would have been really ugly. So that was pretty miraculous. Absolutely. Yeah. And yes. And then I have the privilege of working with so many women. Some of them have severe trauma, survivors of human trafficking. I've worked with other women that have had all kinds of addictions and compulsions. And what we do is periodically, probably about every 3 to 4 months, we have these deep experiential weekends where we invite women to come. We create a safe space and they can go deep and really deal with some of the issues that, you know, are very hurtful, and they're going to continue to affect them for the rest of their life if they don't deal with them. So I could tell you so many different situations on those weekends where I literally see the transformation from the time they come Friday night, or it could be a Saturday morning until Sunday afternoon. We have different timelines for the things that we do, but literally seeing the change in their countenance and just how they carry themselves and how they look once they go through that process. So I have the privilege of being on holy ground with many women, and I get to see those miracles every single time we have those weekends.
You know, what is really remarkable is, I mean, besides for the work that you do, which I'm still trying to find all the correct adjectives to use about how amazing it is. I was driving across the US, I think from Chicago to Portland, Oregon, because I was going to live at the coast for the summer to do some house sitting. And I did not know human trafficking was this plague. It's a worldwide plague, but it happens in the US until I, you know, started stopping in the rest areas. And every single rest area, I would go in to go to the bathroom, and there I would close the door, and there would be a big poster or a big sign on the inside of that door, and said, it would say, if you are the victim of human trafficking, please call this number. And I mean, I just thought, you know, the first one I thought, oh, that's interesting. And then I drove 500 miles and then I stopped for the bathroom again. And there it was again. And I thought to myself, how did I miss that this is just happening all over the states? And it's so egregious and huge that it is, they're needing to put posters up to alert people that, you know, there is hope. And I thought, what have I been paying attention to? But it is a horrific, horrific issue all over the country. I mean, not even to talk about all over the world, where I knew more about that than versus in this country. So I can't even imagine the work you're doing around that. I can't imagine what it would be like to be a survivor of something like that. But then to find a safe place and a safe space with people that I can trust, you know, at your ranch must be the most incredible experience for them. I thank you so much for doing the work that you do.
Yeah, it's you know, I think more people need to understand how prevalent this is And it's happening in families. You know, children are being trafficked by parents. Children are being trafficked by aunts and uncles and cousins. And it's happening in families. And there's the addiction connection, which is part of why I think I ended up in this space, as well as dealing with people with addiction, because there's overlap. So for some of these family members that are trafficking their children, it's because of drugs and alcohol. I mean, it's some of the stories would keep you up at night. They truly would. And it's this work is not for the faint of heart. You have to be able to release those burdens and not carry them. And hearing the stories and being able to let go of the stories, because I think part of the reason why I'm able to let go of some of the stories is because I see the freedom that happens on the other side when they begin to share, and the shame that is broken off of their life and the healing that can happen. So, yeah, I think that's how I kind of ended up in this space, because just working with people who have addictions and they're in recovery, and the safer they feel, they start opening up about these things. And then I've actually gotten connected with other ministries and other organizations that are, you know, so we partner a lot, you know, we're helping each other help as many people as we can.
I want to ask you, how do you take care of yourself doing this work?
I have to stay balanced, that's for sure. So self-care is critical. So getting my exercise, getting out in the sunlight, working in my garden, to me, that's therapy for me. My husband is wonderful. We're sounding boards for each other that we need to just process and pray. The other thing is, you know, having that downtime, that Sabbath rest. I think that you've got to have at least a few hours every single week where you just disengage and go off and just spend some time. So since we live in Southwest Florida now, which I'm originally from Michigan, and I still go back to Michigan, and we're still doing like a branch of life care there. So I still do the weekends for women there. And then we have a couples weekend that we do. But here, you know, you have the availability of getting to a beach somewhere or just hanging out for a few hours and read a book or just take a snooze or just listen to the ocean waves. And obviously, when I was going after my brain health coaching certification, I learned the value of listening to the waves and feet in the sand. It's just a wonderful experience to just chill. And so those are some key things that we do for self-care.
I love that. You know, when I lived in Portland, I actually left for about 3 months to help take care of a dear friend on the southeast coast of Florida near Jupiter. And she was having experimental brain surgery for Parkinson's up in Gainesville. But I drove and left my life and came down and lived with her and her nurses for a few months. And, you know, in Oregon, you have to wear a wetsuit to go in the water. I mean, or you will just turn into an icicle. So yeah. I remember driving to town and going to the beach, and I could not believe it. I couldn't believe it. It was so beautiful and so warm. And it was kind of like at 10 or 11 in the morning. So really there was no one on the beach yet. It was also March. So not a lot of people were on the beach yet. But I remember, you know, there's something about putting your feet in the sand, feeling the sand on your feet, and then just sitting down, closing your eyes, listening to the waves, or staring off at the horizon with the sea that goes on forever. It is so relaxing and amazing. It's like a full experience.
Yes. And it's a proven fact. Neurologically, it brings everything down a few decibels. It really does. It's just like,
oh, I'm so grateful you have the so good near you. Well, I want to just tell you, I'm unbelievably grateful for your spirit, for being as stalwart as it is, for having so much fortitude, for willing to be, you know, showing up every day for these people who have gone through things that I don't even want to imagine, because human beings can be quite cruel to each other. And really, and I know a lot of times, you know, that trauma or the cruelty we inflict on others is based on how we were treated when we were kids. And so it's kind of that, you know, they talk about ancestral trauma. It just kind of keeps repeating until someone says, I like the way you said that earlier. Stop. This is, we're not going to go any further with this behavior. That takes a real wake up call to kind of stop that cyclical occurrence of the trauma and visiting it on other people. So first of all, I'm grateful for your spirit, which is just kind of unstoppable, frankly. And I'm grateful that you're so wise that you take time for yourself to regenerate and renew your spirit and your batteries. But I'm also so grateful that you've created this ranch and this place where people feel safe and they feel welcomed and they can create a sense of belonging and, you know, belonging with safety, because I think that's essential as well. So thank you so much for the work you're doing. It's unbelievable.
Oh, well,
and
thank you.
You are, and for who you are.
And you're so kind. Thank you. Thank you.
Just as a little side note, I wanted to ask you, I am fascinated by names. And when I saw your name, I thought, my God, that is beautiful. So where does Easterly come from and what does it mean?
Yeah, well, that I think is, I kept my first married name because a lot of my licenses were under Easterly. And now I'm Smith, so it's Easterly Smith. And then my first name, Lillian, came from my grandmother. And that's becoming popular now, which it never was when I was growing up. I was the only Lillian in our whole school. Like, so yeah, the Easterly part of it, I love that the Easter is a part of that name. And I'm okay with that being, you know, my ex's last name, but Easter was always my favorite holiday. So I don't look at Easterly as like a direction. I look at it as like Easter is, wow, you know, that's my favorite. New life.
Oh, I love that. See, I love pirates. And so I saw Easterly and I thought, Easterly wind, and I am automatically associated with pirates. So I love where our minds go around that. That's really fabulous.
Yes, that's good. I like that too. I'm going to remember that.
Just to let you know, Aruka is the Hebrew word which means to heal, restore, and rebuild, to bring into wholeness. And there is no doubt in my mind that Aruka Ranch is doing just that for everyone who passes through their doors. Now, rebuilding a life, especially when one has suffered such incredible trauma, looks different for each of us, in that we're all not going to need the same tools and messages that everyone else is going to. But the work that Lillian is doing, the work that her husband's doing, the work that the ranch is doing, is speaking to so many people. I don't think that everyone understands that about 20 million people had a substance use disorder in 2019.
and about 42% more people were homeless in Lee County, Florida, alone in 2021. And now 60% more are homeless after Hurricane Ian in 2022. It's this silent epidemic that I think either we don't want to witness or it's happening in front of us and we just don't recognize it. But Lillian and her husband and the ranch are here to help those who escape the clutches of addiction, of homelessness, and human trafficking. And for that, I am grateful. There will be a link in the episode show notes, so please do check out the work that the ranch is doing. It's so important. I just want to thank everyone who listens to this podcast and everyone who's left a rating or written a review. I'm so grateful to you. You have no idea. It just makes me so happy. So thank you. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Lillian. Lillian has always, her entire life, even in the depths of her addiction, I feel like some part of Lillian's soul always wanted to rise. There's just something inside of her that is unstoppable, that refuses to let go of the vision of something better. And so eternally we can look at Lillian because she's always rising. She's rising to the world and its challenges. She's rising for others so that they may see by her example that overcoming addiction is possible. And she's rising in her day-to-day life because she's just out there. She's being herself. She claims her past. She claims where it's led her. And without shame, without embarrassment, and with so much humility, she says, look, this is who I am, and this is how I can be present to you. And so be like Lillian and be yourself. Own your history, your story, your own self. Be brave in this world and be beautiful. And just know that that self, yourself, and how you show up, it's going to change everything for some people. It can literally change people's worlds. So I'm excited that you're all going to go out and be your best selves and just show up for whoever crosses your path, because we really are building an army. It's an army of people who are unstoppable. It's an army of people who bring beauty. And it's an army of people who show up and are unashamedly and unabashedly themselves.